Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the change that President Obama made and why both the left and the right missed it. Then, scandal and silence, why some misdeeds become scandals and others don't, and how they affect our society. While both the left and the right have focused on unfulfilled promises of the Obama administration, the massive changes that he has led have gone unnoticed. Some of these changes have such transformative potential that our next guest calls them the New New Deal. We are joined by Michael Grunwald. He's an award-winning reporter, senior national correspondent at Time magazine, and author of several books, including The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Welcome, Michael Grunwald. Before we get into the story of the New New Deal, I thought it was one of the most extraordinary introductions I'd ever read because it introduces this idea of what it really means to be creative.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's a book about change. The subtitle of the book is The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And so, yeah, it's a hidden story, but also there was change. And so I did try to tell the story right up front, not only by sort of introducing this notion that there was this gigantic $800 billion stimulus bill that not only prevented a depression, but also turned out to be really the purest distillation of what Obama meant by change. But I thought maybe the purest distillation of that was this agency that was created by the stimulus called ARPA-E. I think I describe it as the kind of place where Q from the James Bond movies would want to work. It's actually the only government agency created by the stimulus. It just has like a couple dozen people working there. And it's modeled on DARPA, which is that Pentagon agency that invented the internet and GPS technology and all kinds of other cool stuff. And the idea was it's just let's put some really smart people together and have them invent really cool ideas that'll help us get off fossil fuels. And so I tell the story about how they came up with electrofuels, which is not only a new different kind of biofuel, it's a whole new realm of science that hadn't been invented before. And not to give it all away, but about two-thirds of the way through the book, they actually do invent a biofuel and it runs a jet engine. We don't know if it'll actually be the next big thing in fuels, but it's pretty amazing.
Well, central to your story about all of this creativity and change is Stephen Chu. Why don't you tell us a bit about Stephen Chu, who he is, and what his role has been?
Sure. Well, he was installed as the energy secretary, which I think was shocking to a lot of people. I mean, it sort of felt like, you know, appointing Einstein to go run the Labor Department or something. Here's this guy who won a Nobel Prize in physics. And obviously, he's really excited about the science. And in fact, electrofuels came out of Steve Chu essentially bitching that photosynthesis was too inefficient, which, you know, it's been working pretty well for a few billion years, but it wasn't good enough for Steve Chu, and he wanted a better biofuel. That's what led to this. So he's definitely a huge ideas guy, and clean energy is really his big idea. He's trying to change the world, and he thinks that the energy department is the place to do it. One thing that I think is misunderstood about Steve Chu is that because he spent so much time in California and the Bay Area, he also understands the business of energy. You may not understand the politics of Washington, but one thing, there's a lot of reporting about clean energy in this book, and it's not just about inventing the coolest new technology. It's about making it cheap. And if it isn't cheap, it doesn't matter. And if it doesn't scale, it doesn't matter. And he's somebody who really understood the kind of the political challenges, not so much, but the economic challenges, the scientific challenges, and really the managerial challenges of taking this sclerotic bureaucracy and turning it into the world's largest clean energy venture fund.
I loved this description you used of him, which was something like he spent 80 hours a day trying to put the Department of Energy into some kind of a really effective manner. And then in his off hours, he tried to invent these cures for cancer.
Yeah, he really did. He published, literally in his spare time, he published this piece in Science that was essentially confirming one of Einstein's, you know, theories of relativity. I mean, this guy's brain operates at a level that people don't understand. I did follow him through this ARPA-E summit where he was looking at the sort of papers that all these whiz-bang scientists were making. And he was asking these guys these questions. I remember I scribbled in my notes, I don't think Hazel O'Leary asked questions like this because, I mean, they were just not the sort of things that cabinet secretaries asked about nanophysics and this. And, you know, I won't do it justice, but my eyes were crossing just listening to him.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you redeemed him for me. Because I had been watching him from the beginning and I really had expected much more faster to occur. And I realized after reading your book about why it went the way it did, and part of it, which is part of your thesis, is that change is hard.
Right. Change is happening, but change is hard. I mean, take energy. We had been spending a few billion dollars a year on clean energy, and the stimulus poured in $90 billion. And now you heard, you know, Paul Ryan making fun of it as green pork when there was actually no pork, no earmarks in the bill. You heard Mitt Romney say that half the companies that got money have failed, when in fact thousands of companies have gotten money, and I know of four that have failed.
Solyndra, what were the others? We didn't even hear the others. So
I think of Solyndra, Abound Solar, NR1, a battery company, and Beacon Power.
Yeah.
But then there are a few thousand, that are doing just fine. But that's the sort of untold story is like everybody knows about Solyndra, right? Which I tell this story in depth in the book. And it's unfortunate, but it's not a scandal. I mean, this is a company that was chosen by the Bush administration out of 143 applicants and had raised $1 billion in private capital and failed because solar got cheap. But the untold story is that solar got cheap, so actually solar installations have increased more than 600% since the stimulus, and wind has more than doubled. You've got unprecedented investments in geothermal and advanced biofuels and better hydropower, and you've jump-started a smart grid, and you've created an advanced battery industry for electric vehicles entirely from scratch. You've created the factories to build all this stuff in the United States. This really was a game changer. I stumbled into this story through energy, because I write a lot about energy. But, you know, once I kind of got curious, I was like, well, I wonder what else is in this thing. And really, it wasn't like I did some great investigative reporting. I did a Google search and I was like, oh, my God, you know, the stimulus is also dragging our pen and paper medical system into the digital era. And it includes Race to the Top, which is the most important education reform in decades. It includes high-speed rail and the largest infrastructure investment since Eisenhower, the largest middle-class tax cuts since Reagan, the largest one-time research investments ever. So it was just clear that there was this gigantic story hiding in plain sight. And then, oh, by the way, it also prevented spectacular economic depression where we were crashing, our GDP was crashing at a 9% annual rate, and we were losing 800,000 jobs a month, and we passed the stimulus, and the next quarter we had the biggest employment improvement in 30 years. And just about every independent economist who looks at it says that it added 2 to 4% to GDP, which really is the difference between contraction and growth. I don't live in Washington anymore. I spent 9 years at the Washington Post. Now I'm in the public policy paradise of South Beach. but there was just such groupthink that this stimulus was just $800 billion worth of levitating trains to Disneyland and mob museums and all kinds of nonsense that wasn't in the actual stimulus. Clearly a story that I got kind of caught up in, and I was enough of a dork to try to follow the money and see what actually happened.
Well, let's back up first into the change is hard part, and then let's go back to the change is happening part, because you have this two-part thesis going on. Mm-hmm. In the change is hard part, you detailed a lot of the obstructions that the Obama administration faced, both within their own party, but mostly from the Republican Party. Let's talk about some of those, starting first, president-elect facing his own party, and then into what actually happened with the opposition party, the Republicans.
After spending all that time in Washington, I did have pretty good Republican sources, and I did kind of grab them right after the 2010 elections was when I did a lot of my Republican reporting, when they were all, you know, kind of fat and happy and gloating and wanting to tell the story of how they plotted their path back to power. And they really opened up to me, and I was able to document these secret meetings that were led by Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House, where even before President Obama took office, they decided that their strategy was going to be no, pure obstruction. even though Mitt Romney, of all the 2008 presidential candidates, had supported the biggest stimulus, even though Paul Ryan, who you may have heard a bit about lately, ended up voting for a $715 billion stimulus that was almost identical to President Obama's $787 billion stimulus that's, you know, the death of American free enterprise. Even though most of the stuff in the stimulus was really pretty uncontroversial stuff, they recognized from the beginning that their path back to power was saying no, and that really did kind of define the Obama era, because look, he understood that bills that don't pass Congress don't make change, and bills that don't get 60 votes in the Senate don't pass Congress, and he had 58 when he took office. And so a lot of the story of the kind of the narrative of the Obama era has been trying to cobble together the votes, which, you know, after campaigning as this sort of change the system outsider, he's really had to govern as this work the system insider. And it's not always pretty, and it requires some compromise. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel was in the middle of a lot of it, so it wasn't really suitable for young ears.
Well, without the expletives, why don't you give us some Rahm Emanuel stories?
Sure. Well, I mean, probably the classic story is when Arlen Specter, who at the time was a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, he decided that he wanted $10 billion in the stimulus for the National Institute of Health. And Rahm said, well, you know, that's bleeping crazy. You know, you can't have $10 billion. And he said, no, it's going to be $10 billion. He said, all right, well, you can have $6 billion. And Arlen Specter said, no, it's going to be $10 billion. And oh, by the way, the stimulus cannot be one dime more than $800 billion. That was his other demand. And Rahm's going crazy. He's like, you know, how the bleep am I going to keep this bleeping thing under $800 billion if I have to give every bleeping senator, you know, senator 10? Joe Lieberman, who was in the room at the time, he told me it was like the noblest shakedown he'd ever seen. Because it wasn't like Specter was asking for some like water project in his district. It was the NIH. But he ended up, he passed it. It was under $800 billion, as Specter insisted. He got his $10 billion for NIH. And guys in the White House often point out that those NIH studies, as noble as they are, they've gotten some of the worst press, right? Because, you know, some of them sound funny. It's like studies of cocaine-addicted monkeys, or, you know, why dudes in college don't like to wear condoms. And that's gotten a lot of press. And every time there's a story like that, they kind of, you know, smack themselves in the head and say Specter. But of course, the other part of that story is that just voting for the stimulus was so unpopular in the Republican Party that Specter ended up switching to the Democratic Party. And that gave them 60 votes to pass health care
reform. So he was number 60.
He was number 60.
And who was number 59?
Al Franken hadn't been seated yet in Minnesota when the stimulus passed. So then by giving him NIH, he ended up passing universal health insurance, this dream of Democrats for 50, 60 years. There are a lot of stories of Rahm screaming all kinds of, well, I was going to say unprintable, I printed it, unspeakable things, you know. Unairable about the Blue Dog Democrats, you know, who were threatening to vote against the stimulus, which he called them, I guess it started with Mother.
Yeah.
But it wasn't it wasn't Mother Goose or Mother Jones. He called Dave Obey, who was they got in a fight over Race to the Top, the groundbreaking education reform. Obey didn't like it and thought it was too much to try to push through during a stimulus bill. And Rahm screamed at it, this isn't your bill, you blank. This is the president's bill. But again, you know, and it wasn't pretty. And there are a lot of stories about how, you know, President Obama, he promised to change Washington. And look, this is the same old Washington. But one of the things about promising bipartisanship is that the other party can turn you into a liar just by saying no. And then you have to deal.
Let's talk about that other side now, because,
sure.
Well, one of the people you mentioned earlier, Mr. Ryan, was in this group that you called the Young Guns.
That's right.
Tell us who the Young Guns are and what their entire mission had been.
Sure. This was Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy and Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan was seen as sort of the budget wonk of the sort of young Republicans. These kind of young conservative guys who sort of look like investment bankers. They have that kind of same lean and hungry look. They weren't interested in sitting around in the minority for another 20 years. And Cantor called this meeting, right, in December 2010. And remember, this took some guts, right? This was at a time when Democrats had just helped President Bush bail out the banks. President Obama had just been elected and by a pretty substantial margin. There had just been a few million people out on the mall saying, yes, we can, yes, we can. It was the first black president. It was an economic emergency. And Republicans had just gotten pasted for their second straight election. And what, they weren't going to work with this guy? All the pundits were saying, like, you know, obviously they're going to have to cooperate. But Eric Cantor said, no, we're going to fight. Mitch McConnell recognized, he used to talk about the 1984 election, which everybody remembers because Ronald Reagan, right, Morning in America, won in a big landslide. Well, what Mitch McConnell remembered was that only one Democratic incumbent in the Senate lost that year. And McConnell remembered because he's the one who beat him. But what he told his caucus was, look, if this guy, all the economists are telling us this is going to be an unbelievably deep and nasty downturn. If this guy somehow turns things around in 2 years, we're all going to get reelected. Doesn't matter what we do. People get reelected when the voters are feeling good. But if he fails to turn water into wine and the economy is still struggling in 2010, that's our ticket back to power, as long as we just say no. And he said, like, the most important thing is we've got to stick together. And to their political credit, not their moral credit, they really did. They were very shrewd. Rather than fighting or compromising or trying to cut a deal, they just portrayed this as $800 billion worth of condoms and sod on the mall and turtle tunnels and snowmaking machines in Duluth and honeybee insurance and all kinds of crazy stuff. No, it wasn't true at all. But it was a good story, and they stuck to it. While Democrats were mostly quibbling, oh, it's too small, or it's too many tax cuts.
Like they were actually thinking about the policy implications.
Right, right. Or, you know, or I don't like this provision, or it's not shovel ready enough, or, you know, maybe it should be even more transformative. Why isn't it more like the original New Deal? And Republicans had this very simple message: no, big government. Big spending, you know, big mess. And they never changed that message. While then Obama had plenty of, you know, they were fighting over what their message was going to be. It was all muddled. By the time they finally passed it, then it was on to the unpopular auto bailout, and then on to even more unpopular healthcare reform and
unpopular. Which are all turning out to be more and more popular now.
Well, it's funny. I was just on a panel with a friend of mine who ran for governor in Massachusetts as a Republican recently, and he read my book, and what he said is his big takeaway was, if you get power, do stuff.
This is part one of a two-part interview with Michael Grunwald on the New Deal, the hidden story of change in the Obama era. We'll continue with part two next week. When we come back, scandal and silence, why so many scandals go unnoticed, why some become national stories, and how this phenomena affects our society. Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
Our statues, the soaring edifice of our times, detracted from the ways of the wise. The future will view all history as a crime. So, Father, tell us, when is the time to rise? They crown the sons. They crown the sons.
Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. What makes some misdeeds rise to the level of scandal, while others fade out, hardly noticed? Why is it that the same type of transgressions are treated differently at different times? And might this differential treatment affect our politics, policies, and society? With us are three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs at George Washington University and author of numerous books, including Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and his latest, Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Brendan Nyhan is also with us. He is professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, the Media, and the Truth. Sigurd Allern also joins us from Stockholm. He is professor of journalism studies at the University of Oslo and Stockholm University and author of Scandalous, the Mediated Construction of Political Scandals in Four Nordic Countries. So you all study this scandal and mass media, this intersection between scandal, mass media, and public understanding of scandal. I thought we should start with a context about why it's important for the public to understand these scandalous issues and why it's important for scholarship to delineate what it all means for us. Bob Entman, why don't you lead us with why this is important?
Perhaps the primary duty of a media in a democracy is to alert the public to what their leaders are up to. And when leaders are misbehaving, if they're acting in an incompetent fashion, a corrupt fashion, it seems to me there's essentially nothing more important for the media to tell us about. And when those things happen, sometimes call them scandals. The other thing that media need to do is hold the officials accountable. So it's not merely a matter of alerting the public to the misconduct, but making sure that enough information is out that the public and other leaders will pursue the matter until the guilty party, if he or she is guilty, is held accountable.
So in essence, there's an accountability issue, but there's also a democratic issue attached. Would you say that's the case?
Absolutely. In countries where corruption is ignored or papered over, those places are less functioning democracies.
Brendan Nyhan.
Well, I agree with Bob. It's a hugely important issue. You just have to look at recent political history in this country. Three of the last eight presidents were forced out of office or had their tenure seriously threatened by scandal, Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton. And scandal has frequently dominated the national political discussion and debate in place of more substantive policy issues. So there's two sides to this coin. On the one hand, as citizens, we want our leaders to be held accountable when there is misconduct. But on the other hand, there may be cases where allegations of misconduct get wide publicity, even though they're not well substantiated. And we've seen examples of both of those. And the media seems to get it wrong at least as often as they get it right. So it is very important to think about how this process works.
So then we have this aspect of false alarms and false accusations that we should get into. Sigurd Allern, is there anything you'd like to add to this context?
I agree that political scandals often function as a sort of political control. They form us. They are necessary and healthy for democracy. And I basically accept that argument. But I think it also would be naive to interpret any mediated scandal as a strengthening of democratic processes. You have superficial scandals, you have more irrelevant scandals, so we have also to ask what type of scandals are important.
And that would get us right into the substance of the research that the three of you are doing. It seems that there are two general myths in the United States about mass media and scandal, and both seem wrong according to your research. The first deals with, say, the Watergate scandal as evidence of the media's vigilance. But then there's the second narrative that mass media focuses on only scandal that doesn't really have major public implications but are really private matters like sex scandals. Let's start with your core findings and what it says about these myths.
First of all, the idea that the media are hungering for scandal in any form is truly misleading. It implies that, first of all, that the media are in control of whether there's a scandal or not, and that really isn't the case. It ignores the fact that in many cases, perhaps most cases, knowledge that is fairly well rooted in confirmed fact is often ignored, even when it has to do with sex scandals, and most certainly when it has to do with much more serious substantive abuses of power, incompetence, and corruption. So I think it's awfully important that we understand that the media are not vigilantly on guard against either all trivial scandals or all important scandals. It's a much more complicated process determining whether we have a scandal or not that has relatively much less to do with what the person actually did and much more to do with things like which party is more skilled, which political party has the most incentive to promote a scandal. And when you have a situation, for example, where neither party in the United States or none of the parties in multi-party democracies are interested in promoting a scandal, you won't really get one, even if the media want one.
So then it brings up the role of the political elites, the elected officials, rather than the journalists as sitting in the driver's seat. Is that how your research has panned out?
Yes, I think for the most part, if the leaders, if at least some important leaders, aren't really interested in promoting a scandal over a matter, it won't happen, no matter how serious the underlying misconduct is.
Brendan Nyhan, is this also what your research has found?
I largely agree with Bob on this. I've described scandal as a co-production, typically in the case of U.S. presidents, between the media and the opposition party. It's certainly true that the media can't create scandal on its own in most cases, but there's often a synergistic relationship with the political party when people, at least some people, as Bob said, in that party, want to create a scandal. So a good example of when this doesn't happen is the period after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, when many, if not most, Democrats at the national level were wary of going after President Bush, who still had high approval ratings and a wartime president aura. And so allegations that might have turned into scandals in other contexts typically fizzled and died because the opposition party was wary. But it also was a case where the media, too, was wary of challenging a wartime president who had this aura around him.
And is that how it occurs in Europe as well, Sigurn Alern?
In the Nordic countries in Europe, we have another media system, another political system, and countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark just some decades ago were looked upon as more or less a scandal-free zone. But that has changed, and our research shows that in the last decade, there has been a large increase in media reports about different types of scandals. But when you look into it, only around 40% of national political scandals was directly concerned with politics. More than 60% were personal acts in a more or less private role or a personal act in a sort of political role. But it were very few, relatively few political scandals, which really was about politics and important political questions.
Let's use some specific examples that our audiences can relate this to. Bob Entman, you looked at several different kinds of scandals in your book and found that, for example, media are very inconsistent with even the sexual misconduct. They have gone after some, such as Bill Clinton, and they haven't gone after others, including John McCain and George H.W. Bush. Why the discrepancy?
The discrepancy has a lot to do with the particular alignment of forces at a particular time. In the case of Clinton, you had an opposition party, the Republicans, who were determined to undermine him and use every lever they could, and he gave them quite a wonderful opportunity with his actual behavior, which was confirmable by scientific analysis. In the case of the senior Bush, John McCain, Bob Dole, you had somewhat less direct or scientific evidence, although I dare say you had enough evidence to convict in most courts, and yet the media sat on this information, gossiped about it privately, but never blew it up into a scandal. I think in each of those cases, you may argue that it wasn't the media's fault. In fact, maybe the media did the right thing. The real problem is the inconsistency. What that means is that the media intervene in the outcome of elections. So that, for example, in 1996, they admitted after the election that they sat on information about Bob Dole's infidelity, which, in fact, was quite clearly known in Washington among the insiders. And they did so for this kind of murky reason about the long time ago, and we don't want to invade his privacy. Well, If that were a consistent standard, I think it would be good, actually. But it's not. That didn't hold for Bill Clinton. It may or may not hold in the future. It's the inconsistency that I think is particularly troublesome. And it also means that when, as in the case of Clinton, one of the parties is determined to get this information out, it may get out and distort the electorate's view of their politicians. Because let me tell you that the rate of these kinds of things among politicians in Washington is very high.
This also occurred with very substantive issues beyond sexuality, which you noted. The New York Times sat on a George W. Bush, I think you called them potential scandals, dealing with spying on Americans. How do we explain this?
Well, in that case, I think you had the national security claim, which presidents, when they can use it, it's usually pretty effective. Indeed, I think it helped George W. Bush in quite a few contexts. But here's another example with George W. Bush. He engaged in insider stock trading while his father was president. It was investigated by the regulatory authorities, and they found insufficient evidence to pursue the matter. Now, if you compare that to what happened under Clinton, where there was, as we all know, many millions of dollars expended for years and years on an investigation of every possible detail, which ultimately led to Monica Lewinsky, you see the level of inconsistency that if a president's business dealings prior to being president are relevant to the public, then they should be consistently relevant. And in that case, in essence, the Bush family covered up what George W. Bush had done quite successfully. And you mentioned Watergate. Let me just say that the biggest problem with Watergate is that people assume that that is the typical political scandal instead of what it is, which is the unique political scandal that actually did lead to the fall of a president because of corruption.
Brendan Nyhan.
A couple of things. The discussion we're having, I hope, underlines for your audience the extent to which scandals aren't simply a function of whether there's evidence of misconduct or credible allegations, which has been a subtext of a lot of what we're talking about. But I think it's important because that's typically how people think about scandal. The other point that we haven't quite brought up is the way in which an allegation is consistent with a view of a politician, a stereotype, is often quite powerful. So Clinton had a persona as a womanizer or flirtatious or someone who had problems in his marriage. And so the allegations against him fit with that persona, which had been brought to the surface during his primary campaign with the Jennifer Flowers allegations. So the Monica Lewinsky allegations were already been legitimized, whereas Dole was injured in World War II quite substantially. John McCain was seen as a war hero, and it was less consistent with the public personas of those men.
There's one other piece, Brendan Nyhan, that I wanted to ask you about before we go back over to look at the European examples. One of the things you wrote about was how these scandals get buried with other pressing stories and how politicians use these more pressing issues to avoid the scandals becoming publicized.
I think this is an important piece of when scandals happen. We've talked about the strategy of a party going after someone on a scandal or not, but there are also things that are outside of your control. In the case of my research, I've looked at things like, does a hurricane hit? Is there a mass shooting? Is there an earthquake? Things that dominate the news out of nowhere. But you can think of lots of other examples. When there are big events in the news, it displaces other stories. And sometimes the media's attention is elsewhere. They're devoting their resources to covering other stories, and they're not as interested. In other cases, the media are bored. They're sitting around looking for something to write about. This is the classic story of the slow news period that is often told about the summer, but it can happen almost any time of year when the political media really has nothing to write about. And in those circumstances, an allegation which might get ignored in a different context can take off.
Sigurd Ahlern, let's take a look at how this is playing out in Europe. What are some specific examples?
There's a lot of differences in Europe. If you look at the UK, you have had scandals concerning what you call sex scandals. You have politicians with mistresses and so on. The same conduct in France is no scandal. It has been a change of climate because of the last affair, but in most European countries, you have other norms, which can make the type of mediated scandals different. In Nordic countries, you normally do not write a lot about politicians' sexual affairs, and you did not write about politicians with problems with alcohol, but there has been a change in the last decade. Well-known example in the Nordic countries is Finland, where it was possible for a politician 2-3 decades ago to have grave alcohol problems without this being a scandal or looked upon as a scandal. But today the climate, the norms have changed. So the demands concerning a politician's conduct are other than before, and therefore such affairs can be scandalized in another way. So the norms are changing and influencing what's talked about and what's looked upon as scandals. In many cases, political scandals are not built upon great revelations, muckraking, a lot of investigating journalistic works. It's based on leaks. It's based on leaks from different political actors who use scandalizing in the political process. Most journalists, when we discuss scandals, are referring to, also referring in Europe and the Nordic countries, to Watergate. But I agree that the Watergate example is also for European journalism quite untypical.
Bob Entman.
I was just going to ask Professor Allen about the degree to which there is consistency now. Are they consistently going after every sex scandal, or is it more depending on different rivalries and different political interests?
I do not think they are consistently going after sexual scandals. There have been a few scandals, and in Norway, to an example, several of them have been about the opposition right-wing party called the Progressive Party, which has been a sort of underdog in the political system. So I think there is clear differences between how politicians are treated, yes.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle. We are analyzing why some transgressions become scandals while others don't, and how it affects our society and politics. There are some things that all three of you are pointing to, and some of this has been in your work already, and that is that it seems like some of the determinants are, A, that the scandal is easy to go after and easy to confirm. It's either been laid out already by the opposition party, or there are hearings being held, as in the case of Watergate, which, Bob Entman, you have written about and talked about quite a bit. Very easy to point a finger to somebody, so there's a personalization element to it. But it seems there's also another piece that is not being talked about, which is political power. Bob, you wrote about this too, and I wanted to see if you might address it, where the more powerful people tend to be scrutinized perhaps the most carefully.
It's interesting because I think the stereotype of the media tends to be that the more powerful you are, the more vulnerable you are, and the more careful you have to be. But my research suggests that because of some of the things we've already talked about, you really can't make that claim. And in fact, you might argue that the more powerful you are, in many cases, the less likely you are to be held accountable. So, for example, if a president is very popular and to the point that the opposition party may be reluctant to attack very hard, that translates into a protection for the incumbent, even if certain allegations arise. And the second point about this that I think is very important for your audience and Americans to understand is that frequently the most serious corruption may involve institutions. For example, let's say the Federal Reserve Bank and the Securities and Exchange Commission, thinking about the horrible economic meltdown of the last few years and the numerous crimes that were committed by major banks and the lack of regulation and I think conflicts of interest between people who were in government but who wanted to have a career in banking and vice versa. All of that has yielded, as everyone in the audience knows, no scandal. There has been nobody who's gotten in trouble or been held accountable for this. And in that case, you have to say, of course, the cause of this misconduct is sort of the entrenched way the system operates. In that sense, it is the very most powerful institutions and the most deeply rooted causes of the problems that may yield corruption that are the least vulnerable to truly being revealed and held accountable.
I think that at least our research in the Northern Europe show that most scandals are about or limited to individual personal or moral transgressions, and very few of them involve institutional questions or structural questions or institutions. And you also have, I think, several examples in the Nordic countries showing that relatively grave accusations and in some ways attempts for scandals concerning important members of government, like the Swedish foreign minister, Carl Bildt, with his relations to oil company, with interests in Africa. There has been a lot of debates. He's sort of untouchable in the Swedish government. He's too important. It's quite impossible that Carl Bildt should lose his position as long as this government is in power. But if you are a minor member of government, if you're not so important, if you are a minor politician, relatively speaking, well, then you much more easily will lose your position if it's a coalition government, if you fall under smaller parties and so on. We have seen that in Sweden, we have seen that in Denmark, we have seen the same thing in Norway. And in general, we also found that around the double, if we compare men and women in government positions, and when women in government positions are being scandalized, around 60% of the female members of government scandalized had to go. They lost their position. Around 60% of the men kept their position. They were just criticized. So there is a difference. And if you're important, if you have a real strong position, the consequences will be another than if you are a minor member of government or not so important politician.
Bob Entman, that sounds very similar to some of the things that you found in terms of power, and that the people who are least powerful or a few steps down from the person of power tend to be the ones that take the fall. But there's one other piece that I wanted you to address, and that is you mentioned that cover-ups often work, and that's why they're practiced. And number two, there's been a practice of going after media themselves, such as in the case of Dan Rather and others. Can you talk about how that offense's defense is affecting media's ability to expose scandal?
I think it's important to realize, and this is very much contrary to the conventional wisdom, that cover-ups do work. You know, we often hear that the best advice for a politician accused of wrongdoing is to get all the facts out right away and just lay them all out and apologize. Well, sometimes they do that, and sometimes it works. But quite often they do engage in cover-ups, and quite often they work. You know, it's only if you assume that the media have this extraordinary degree of investigative power does it make sense not to try a cover-up if that looks like it might succeed. As an example, think about how when the issue arose of Mitt Romney's tax returns, there's a lot of writing about this in the media early on when it first came up that said, well, he's going to have to release them anyway, so why doesn't he just get it all out now, early in the campaign? And I have to say that I predicted, no, he would cover them up. And that was his best strategy, and it is working, and it will probably continue to work. So we really need to understand the notion that cover-ups don't work is wrong. They often do work, and they are a good strategy, which means for the average citizen that you're not finding out about a lot of potential scandals.
Brendan Ion, would you agree?
Well, this gets into the difficulty of studying scandal, which is agreeing on what a scandal is or what a potential scandal is. It's often very difficult. It involves subjective judgments about what is or is not misconduct, what is or is not inappropriate, what actions are or are not justified. And those are very hard for us to agree on, even just as scholars. And then for the larger public, which is, of course, very polarized, especially the people who follow politics closely, it's very hard to agree on what is or should be a scandal. So it is difficult to say that something should have been a scandal and wasn't. I think we can agree, though, in some cases, that here's a candidate that looks like something that could have been a scandal if things had broken differently. Maybe we don't agree normatively on whether the action actually was misconduct or not, but we can say, I can imagine this being a scandal. And that may be unsatisfying, especially when it comes to people we don't like. We're often quick to rush to those normative judgments that they did something wrong. And that's part of what makes scandal so powerful, but it also makes it so hard to figure out what should be a scandal or not.
That brings up three things, really. One is your notion that the mass media professionals act like juries or act like chaplains or judges in their framing of the issue, having it either rise to the level of a scandal or not. But it also brings up two other really important points. One is the scandalization of things that may not have anything to do with a true scandal, such as if you watch some of the very conservative television and radio, and they have tried to scandalize climate science, calling it a fraud. And there is a healthy population who actually think that climate scientists are perpetuating a fraud.
That's actually an excellent example, the so-called Climategate, which was trumped up out of very flimsy evidence and yet was enormously successful as a political tactic, because you see that after that scandal arose, the amount of denial of climate change actually went up. Now, there may be other forces behind that change, but I think there's substantial evidence that that was a successful political strategy. And it again points to the fact that there is not a close connection between the underlying facts of the matter and whether or not, and the degree to which, something is framed as a scandal. In that case, you know, we have pretty strong scientific evidence that there is climate change, and the idea that thousands of scientists around the world are conspiring stretches the imagination, to say the least. Nonetheless, it was successfully used to the point that a good amount of the media coverage, not all of it, but a good amount of the media coverage, at least for some time after that, felt obligated to sort of treat the climate change deniers on an equal footing with the scientists who say it is happening.
Sigurd Allern.
Well, I think that in Northern Europe, at least, there is a relatively strong consensus concerning the dangers of climate change. But of course, you have others and some oppositional voices about this. But we have another problem, I think, because the basic idea in our part of the world, at least in the Nordic region, is that it's possible for rich countries to buy themselves out of it, to buy climate quotas and use the money to let poorer nations solve the problem, so to say, so we can go on like before. And I would say, coming from Norway, oil-rich and oil and gas production country, it's very difficult to mobilize real investigating journalism attacking some of the interests of the big oil companies and the state, who itself is one of the large oil exporters in the world. So in such affairs, journalism will meet very strong forces. It's difficult to make revelations that really counts. And I think that's a general problem here, that critical journalism needs a lot of knowledge, it needs a lot of resources. And if you don't have them, and if you're under a commercial enterprise, it's difficult to get such resources when the investigations and what you do is opposite of business interests.
There are three last things I'd like to address. One pertains to things that never really get to the level of scandal, like the issue of torture that we saw in the Bush administration, and specifically when the Obama administration released the document showing they'd tortured not to get confessions, but to falsely connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11, and why that never rose to the level of scandal. Bob Antman, why didn't this very serious issue rise to the level of a scandal?
I think at least two reasons. First of all, both parties are somewhat implicated in this problem. There's evidence that certain people in the Democratic Party were briefed, and so any thorough investigation could get both parties in trouble. Second of all, it was really Obama's call when he became president not to look backward, but only to look forward. And I think a part of that decision was based on the need to appear tough on terrorism. Nobody was going to outflank Obama on the right by saying he wasn't tough on terrorism. So among his decisions was, I'm not going to, you know, go over this torture business anymore. So there, it's just another one of many that we've talked about, examples of where a media report and even stuff that is confirmed factually doesn't necessarily in any way mean that there'll be a scandal of any significance.
We are currently in an election. How is this affecting the election today? And Brandon, again, I'm going to point to you because you've looked at Obama and his particular avoidance of scandal for a very long period of time.
To a large extent, it's been the dog that hasn't barked of the Obama administration. There's been relatively little scandal under President Obama. There's a few different reasons that I've suggested why that might be. The first was the economy has struggled, so the Republicans have had a core issue. One of the reasons potentially that Republicans pursued Clinton so aggressively on scandal was, especially in his second term, was that the economy was doing quite well, and so they were looking for alternative grounds to criticize him. The other thing, we mentioned personality and consistency with narratives, and Obama's personal background as an adult that he wrote about in his book, he has very few allegations against him personally, and so things didn't line up with a stereotype or perception of his administration. And the final thing is just there were a huge number of big news events during the first couple years of Obama's administration, not just the economic collapse, but the oil spill in the Gulf, the Arab Spring. There have just been a series of large news events that have kept people busy and kept the media's focus elsewhere.
Now, there were a couple of attempted scandals. One was Fast and Furious, and one was Solyndra, but they kind of fizzled out.
Yeah, they might have gotten just over the threshold of they were briefly considered as scandals in the national media, but they certainly never registered at the level of the big scandals that we think of over the past 20 or 30 years. They're kind of simmering below the surface. Now, it's possible that these allegations about the consulate security in Benghazi could be the first real Obama scandal. The issue came up in the vice presidential debate, and I expect we'll hear more about it.
Good, Alden here. I want just to add that sometimes what happens in the U.S. and things the United States are responsible for in the world, well, maybe it's not treated as a political scandal in the U.S., but sometimes it's certainly treated like a political scandal in, like, the European and Nordic media. They abuse the questions about torture, the lies about weapons of mass destruction and so on. There has been really a lot of critiques. I have there is a large difference. It has, of course, with the political things to do. And I think if the election, the American presidential election was in Europe, Obama would have got 85% of the vote.
Sigurd Allen, you had mentioned in your own work this very important role of the norms of a society, kind of the values that they hold dear, because scandal is, of course, a violation of those norms. And news media tend to focus on violations of norms. But then there's a role that news media play in setting up those norms and values as well. So how do you see this playing out in a comparison of Europe versus the United States?
The social media is important, but I think that concerning politics, at least as we have experienced it, social media mostly have a political role when the traditional media, newspapers, televisions, channels, and so on, pick up what's going on there. Very few of the debates and what's happening in the social media have a sort of direct impact on the large public sphere. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, let's toss it back over to Bob Entman then to take a look at this in the context of the election, the social media, the polarization that is going on.
One interesting point that Professor Allen raises is that there may be the paradox that there's more scandal reporting in Europe about what's going on in America than there is in America. So the citizens of Europe may have better information about some of the corruption that goes on in the United States or the misconduct than Americans themselves. And surely that is not the ideal situation. Normally we would want, you know, the country's own media to do a pretty good job. On the other hand, we've talked about all the ways in which it's difficult for the media to do that. I tend to think that social media can help to surface an issue. They can possibly give it a little more energy to be on the radar screens of politicians and journalists. But ultimately, the main gatekeepers remain really a handful of elite media in Washington and New York. And if they don't decide that they are going to go into this and cover it repeatedly and prominently, it doesn't really matter very much what's in the social media. I gave an example in the book the John Edwards sexual escapades, which had all of these incredibly salacious and newspaper-selling kinds of details, including a love child. This was ignored by the mainstream media for months and months, even though it had scandal written all over it. That would be an example of something that if you were looking at the right blogs and at the right Twitter feeds and so on, you could actually find out about it. But politically, it was the tree falling in the forest and no one was there.
There are two big questions lingering. One kind of ties back to how we opened this discussion, which is what is the effect on the public? And I wonder if when mass media do not adequately cover these scandals, if we are then building kind of a culture of corruption.
I certainly wouldn't go that far. I think people in Washington are very concerned about being exposed. You may not turn into a scandal, but there are lots of people who've had their reputations ruined and ended up in jail or spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, even when they didn't really do anything. So are there ways our system could be improved? Of course. Is our political system perfect? No. But this is a difficult case because, again, it's very hard to agree on what the corruption is that we should be covering and how we should be holding officials accountable. And those are very hard lines to draw. I think the media could do a better job, but I wouldn't go so far as to say they're creating a culture of corruption.
Sigurd Allen?
I wouldn't use those words, but still I think that Professor Rentman in his book about scandal and silence has some important points concerning the lack of real critical journalism and watchdogs concerning the financial elites, the leading banks, what they do. And when you discover that they have a very negative role concerning the societal economy, they are bailed out. It's a lack of proportion between all the time we use to discuss minor scandals, minor revelation about individual problems and so on, and the lack of concentration of journalistic research and criticism on the important things concerning both the American and other society. I think that's an important point.
Bob Entman.
This problem of failing to track the seriousness of the misconduct, it sounds like this is a problem not only in the United States but in Europe. And the one thing I guess I would ask members of the audience, citizens, to be aware that they really need to think for themselves and not judge whether an individual politician is corrupt or a certain series of actions are scandalous. They have to judge that for themselves rather than waiting for the media to package it as a scandal, because that might not happen. And I'd also ask journalists to be much more self-aware of this problem of calibrating the degree to which they frame something as a scandal and the underlying facts and the seriousness of the impact on the American people. We, I think, would have an improved democracy and a reduction of corruption if that calibration could be brought more into line.
Well, thank you all so much. Bob Entman, Brendan Nyhan, and Sigurd Allern, thank you all so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and assistant producers Amanda Vigil and Kenneth Jackson. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, your girl.